Hi, Geekscapists. The Geekscape Podfather, Jonathan, here. In May, we lost one of our own. Longtime Geekscapist Christopher Ellis, who was a friend and a part of our geek community from the very beginning. Chris even met his wife Sarah through our podcast, and their 2015 wedding seemed like a giant Geekscape party. Chris's final weeks battling in the hospital shed light on a huge national problem. The COVID pandemic has almost completely depleted our national and local blood banks. These supplies are used by thousands of hospitals to provide life-saving treatments to patients or to buy enough time for loved ones just to say goodbye. So for the next month and beyond, we're going to do it big in Chris's memory and do some good in the process. We're throwing a blood drive. Visit www.aabb.org to find a donation center near you or visit other blood and platelet donation centers like the Red Cross. And let's make things interesting. For the next month, take a selfie of yourself donating with the hashtag GeekscapeGives and tag your favorite Geekscape podcast. We'll pick some charitable Geekscapists to send prizes to, and the podcast that gets mentioned the most we'll also get some cool rewards. I should actually cancel the podcast that gets mentioned the least. Can I do that? Whatever. The point is, go out there and donate some blood, tag a selfie of yourself doing it with the hashtag GeekscapeGives, and get others to do the same. We couldn't save our friend Chris, but we can do a whole lot of good in his name. Geekscape forever!
This week, we're joined by Dishwalla bassist Scott Alexander, who tells us what it's like to be in a band with a massive hit, and more importantly, what it's like to hear your song featured on an episode of One Hit Thunder. He's not here to just talk about his massive hit, but also Tal Bachman and his massive hit single, She's So High. Did you know that Tal comes from Canadian music royalty and how many movies and TV shows this song appeared in? Just like Cleopatra, Joan of Arc, and Aphrodite, this week's episode is first class and fancy free, so stay tuned. High above me, she's so lovely, she's so high, like Cleopatra, Joan of Arc, or Aphrodite.
One hit is all you need. Guaranteed, and you can live off royalties forever. And it makes me wonder, is it just a wonder, or is it one hit thunder?
All right, Scott, this is pretty exciting. This is the first time where someone that we discussed their band's song on our show is here after hearing. So I'm assuming the first episode you ever heard of One Hit Thunder is when we talked about Counting Blue Cars, correct?
Yeah, that is correct. Yeah. I actually, when I saw the advertisement that was coming on, I kind of maybe I listened to another one first and just to get a vibe for you guys. And if you were going to rip us apart or how that was going to pan out, because I think it was the one for Player, Baby Come Back.
Okay.
Nice. We all love that song. Yes.
Yeah.
But he didn't get the thunder.
Right.
And so I was a little concerned that maybe it was going to go wrong on the Counting Blue Cars episode. But then
it all worked out. Very interesting about the Counting Blue Cars episode was what I remember. Now, I was kind of dreading. I'm like, I'm not going to listen back. I may have said a few things that may have been like, I don't know, offensive to someone listening. But I do know, and this is the honest to God truth, and this is not knowing that you or anyone in your band was going to hear that episode, was that I liked the song way more by the time we finished the episode.
I did too.
Yeah. See, once I learned, we learned about the song and like analyzed the lyrics. And
exactly.
I think that maybe sometimes for me, when God is mentioned in a song, I turn to like tune it out and not even think about it. Matt, that probably makes Matt like it better. But when I look back on it, I'm like, oh, this song's beautiful. This song's way more. And so I was relieved when I remembered that part of it. And we gave you a thunder, right? It was
you did. You
all
gave
around
us the thunder. And not only that, I mean, yes, with the reading of the lyrics, you know, and going over it, I'm like, wow, this is really kind of poetic, you know, and there's a lot of great imagery. And it kind of reminded me that the lyrics are pretty great in that song. But then not only that, Matt was like, you know, I don't know why this band didn't continue on. Like, the second record was great. In all honesty, I was like driving or something, and I was listening to you guys, and Matt's like, you know, there's this song called Once in a While. It kind of came out as a single. I don't know why it happened. It was just as catchy as Kenny Bucars or whatever, you know, and Matt really dug it. And I was like, Matt's my new buddy, because like that was like I felt like that was like my baby and my contribution to that nice. that record. Yeah. No, that was like one of the first songs I ever wrote. It was something super personal to me.
And I legit love that song, Scott. So I was dreading recording the Dishwall episode knowing Chris. Oh man, am I going to be fighting this by myself on this episode? Right.
No, I wasn't too harsh, was I?
No, it was hilarious. I mean, you guys were really funny. And yeah, there was some jabs, as there's going to be, you know. And you got to remember, though, all these artists that you guys are covering, you know, to us, we're just trying to make music. And it's just like the marketing that came after the fact, most of the time, years after the fact, after these songs were written, is so beyond our control, you know, after touring and doing what we can do that's within our own control. You know, it's in the record company's hands how to market these things. And as we dig into Tal's song, you'll see a lot of like common things, commonalities in between our signing and the choosing of the single and kind of what happened. But in our case, like, you know, that first record, Counting Bucars would not go away. The record, the radio programmers, it was like top, you know, five recurrent airplay is what it's called, for months and months and months after that single came out. And we tried coming out with Charlie Brown's Parents, which was the song we were signed for.
That song's awesome, by the way.
A lot of people thought that song was going to like bring it home. We came out with Give as a single, which is like sort of a power ballad, 70s sounding power ballad that we did a video for. That kind of didn't work out.
I loved Feeder. I know that never got released as a single, but I thought Feeder should have been a single as
Feeder
well.
Rocked,
that song was fantastic.
Live and stuff. That was one of my favorites. But we ran that course of the first record. Sorry if I'm going over this. It's just kind of like...
No,
this
like, please.
Sometimes
fantastic.
Your episodes, it's like, and we don't know what happened. And...
No,
guys,
this is great.
You know, it's just
seal it up. Let us know.
No, and okay, at any rate, we make this second record that we put a lot of work into. We recorded it on our own in the hills above Santa Barbara, California, where we're all from. We built a studio up there. Basically, what happened was Soundgarden was on our label, right? After Super Unknown had a bunch of success, they went to A&M and they're like, we just want to make this record on our own now, this follow-up to Super Unknown. And these dudes had no real studio engineering experience at all, but A&M gave him the recording budget up front instead of the way that it normally works, where there's a producer's fee and recording, you have a recording budget, right? Well, they just gave him the cash, and we went to A&M, we're like, we want to do it like that, give us the cash. So
nice.
So at any rate, because two of the members of our band had previously owned studios, and Jim Wood, our keyboard player, had worked in Los Angeles, was an engineer, and we'd had some years under our belt and some success at that point. So we did the same thing. We flew in this producer from England, which was so totally awesome, but maybe a mistake in the end too, because producers from England kind of don't care about like American radio play and what's going to be feasible in different formats, and they're not cognizant of it. They kind of like, let's just make a trippy record, you know. So we got this guy that had just done Elastica and Ride and a bunch of bands that we kind of liked over there in England, and we brought him to Santa Barbara, California, did this record that we really loved. What happened was we made this record, and then we got the announcement, they already knew it was in the pike, but that A&M and all its subsidiaries under PolyGram are going to be sold to Universal Vivendi. And there was going to be a major corporate takeover, and we got to get this record done. I was like, can't we just delay it till a better time? They're like, it might not come out. So we want to just do it and put it out. I remember being at the studio the day, Toad the Wet Sprocket is also from Santa Barbara, where we're from. We grew up. That's kind of the band that I kind of idolized as a little freshman in high school, right? Because Glenn Phillips, the singer, is a, a junior, you know, he's just a couple years older than me. He's in this band that's got a record deal.
And they had some good songs. Something's Always Wrong is one that comes to me all the time. It's just a really great radio song.
Absolutely. And their two records before, they released two records independently, got a lot of college radio play. And then when they signed to Columbia re-released those two albums under Columbia, which helped fulfill their deal there. But at any rate, I was up at the studio and Toad is recording in our studio, and it's the hottest summer on record of 1998. Was like the hottest summer we'd had on Earth in the United. I don't know if it was on Earth, but at that point it was extremely hot. There's no air conditioning. Toad is in a bad way. Like, they're not getting along. And I come up the driveway to the studio. I'm like, guess what? Number one most added this week at alternative radio or rock radio, whatever it was, Once in a While, our first single off that second record. It looked like it had legs, like it was going to take off. And we were just so ecstatic. And the Toad guys were just like, right on, congratulations, that's so awesome. And then it's sort of like, it just didn't have any financial backing. And it just sort of like just trickled away, you know, rather quickly without the label support. So it looked like radio had belief in it, but then the label wasn't really there to support it. And that was the end of it. We just kind of toured for about a year, and then we fall into the 1999 Tal Bachman year. So that just segues perfectly.
Right. Yeah. But real quick, before we get into Tal Bachman, I got to say, in the past week, I've been at the grocery store shopping for groceries, and Counting Blue Cars was on over the loudspeaker. And I know you have to still experience that all the time, right?
Yeah, all the time. You know, Home Depot or Lowe's.
It
or
has
whatever.
To be a good feeling, though,
cool.
Right?
It's pretty cool. I kind of look around at people, and it's just a trip. You know, it's a sort of an out-of-body experience at this point, you know, because it's been so many years. But I live in a market that has a really good AAA radio station here. And so they play the acoustic version like almost every day. And you know, we've got a couple of these stations that don't have DJs, which is kind of weird, but they play Counting Blue Cars probably every day too. And it's just, it's bizarre, but you know,
it's awesome, man. You made a mark and a big mark on music. You know, that song was so gigantic, and still to this day, it's what we all strive for. And you know, I don't know. Yeah. That's awesome, man. Well, congratulations on that. And thanks for being a good sport about us, about our any jabs we made in our episode. Thanks for being a good sport about it.
You know what? It's going to be one more hit than Chris ever had. So
that's right. But so Tal Bachman, we get into Tal Bachman now. So did you know Tal personally?
I didn't.
Or do
you? Back in the day, you know, I guess to set the stage here, and you know, I don't know where you guys were at in 1999. I think you guys are probably maybe 10 years younger than me.
I was a freshman in college in 99.
I was in eighth grade.
Oh, right on. But you were into music at that point.
I got into music, and my life prior to my cousin lending me Green Day Dookie was only what was in my parents' car. And then, like, that was just what, at a young age, the alternative boom was happening. And I just was, like, glued to MTV and, like, the alternative radio station from, like, up until the point when alternative radio no longer existed in Philadelphia. Like, I was just listening to it, loving it. I was one of those people, and I've talked about it with Chris, like, the thing that drove me to want to do a show like this is that I have always been an album guy. It's great if someone has a good single, but, like, I want to listen to that rest of the record and find any other hidden gems, and I want to, like, be able to put in any album and sing along with it from front to back. So yeah, like, that was just what a, like, the 90s was such a prime time to find these really great albums. Right. And sometimes by bands that didn't, like you said, didn't have the label backing to be something big. And I remember She's So High coming out. This was like right around that same time as Teenage Dirtbag. Like, the song was inescapable. It was always around.
Were you a fan of Tal Bachman? Is that why you chose this? What was your reason for choosing this one?
Yeah. You know, a lot of it with these songs is kind of where you were at that point in time when these songs came on the radio. In 1999, as I was saying before, like, Dishwall is sort of struggling, right? We're in the midst of this corporate label takeover thing that happened. A&M dropped like 100 bands, and they only kept Sheryl Crow, Blues Traveler, Sting, Soundgarden, us and the Gin Blossoms. And they took all of us and they stuck us on Interscope. And I don't know like what the vibe was on Interscope at that point, but new metal had just like, that was the thing in 1999. And all of a sudden, like alternative radio landscape had changed so much that I wasn't really identifying with a whole lot on alternative so much anymore. And that was the case with a lot of us from before. And something I hadn't really thought about much was that like also like a lot of female demographic was totally displaced when Limp Bizkit and Korn and all this stuff. Like, yeah, there's a lot of rocker chicks that like that stuff, but it wasn't Alanis and it wasn't like Sarah McLachlan on alternative radio, like the Lilith Fair, you know, yeah, vibe before. So things had changed a lot. And so when Tal came out, it was like, oh, okay, this is pop rock. This is the direction pop rock is going. And we're on the cusp of Coldplay and Travis and, you know, still Radiohead, but things are getting lighter and they're not being featured on alternative radio anymore. Anyway, I just sort of identified with that particular song because I heard something in it that I loved from my youth, which was like a lot of Electric Light Orchestra, because I loved ELO when I was a little kid. Like, I was raised by a single mom in the hippie era in Santa Barbara, California. Single mom, we had a Volkswagen Bug with an 8-track tape deck in it, right? And I just loved this Out of the Blue ELO record that I played nonstop. When I heard Tal, it was like, oh yeah, his voice and the Lennon-isms and the pop sensibility that he had brought a lot of that sort of, not so much 60s, but more 70s kind of influence into his writing that I just really dug.
I could hear a version of this by like Cat Stevens. You know what I mean? Like, it had that like 70s singer-songwriter vibe when I was revisiting it, when I was reading the lyrics. It's ironic because he had a song on the American Pie, one of the American Pie soundtracks, which obviously also did Dishwalla. So there's an element of his song that makes me think of the song Laid by James a little bit. Like, it feels like those are kind of contemporary songs. And then it was in the movie Loser with Jason Biggs. Tal Bachman and Jason Biggs are like just hand in hand, apparently. But also in that movie soundtrack was Michael Penn's Someone to Dance With. And I feel like all of those songs sit in this very similar like 90s singer-songwriter. Shout out to one of Chris's favorite favorites, Sean Mullins.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like would fall into this category too. Like, that guy with an acoustic guitar, which I think you're right, was almost this direct response to the fact that rock radio was like Godsmack and Disturbed and Limp Bizkit at that time.
Yeah, you want to have a music career, but you're not capable of that. You don't have that in you. So what can you do? Okay, well, I'm just going to go just balls to the wall 70s songwriter and do what I do best. And it worked for him, you know, and it worked for a few guys that found a place because they had the talent, you know. And when you listen to Tal's whole record, that debut record, the whole entire record, from start to finish, is so solid. It's just like every single song. And there is like that Cat Stevens thing that you brought up. There's a track on there that, I mean, it sounds like more like Jim Croce or something like that, but it's totally 70s. And the Wurlitzer, and there's just a lot of 70s elements to it that I love.
I had no clue until doing research, because I was just like, Bachman's a pretty, you know, I don't think it's like an unreasonable last name. Then to realize, oh, he's related to the members of the Guess Who and the Bachman-Turner Overdrive. That's probably got a little bit of the influence on a 70s throwback sound, as well as if you grew up with family members that are playing in those bands. Yeah, you probably are going to have a little bit of 70s influence in your songwriting.
Absolutely. You know, in his defense, I will say he was very smart about it. In case the listeners don't know, Randy Bachman was like, he's basically rock royalty worldwide, but really in Canada, the Guess Who was really the first rock band to break worldwide. And, you know, American Woman,
These Eyes is a jam.
So many hits that are on the oldies stations today are the Guess Who. And so his dad is really kind of royalty up there based on that. And then 70s come around, he's got Bachman Turner Overdrive, BTO,
You ain't seen nothing yet.
Taking care of business.
Yeah, but that's his uncle, though. Wait, so that's his uncle. So he has a dad and uncle who are both part of very big. The crazy thing about BTO is like their songs are like such big songs that they like crossed over into like they're almost like standards, like taking care of business and You Ain't Seen Nothing Yet. Those are like songs that like kids would sing in a Mighty Ducks movie or something. Like those songs are just beyond hits. They're like everybody knows those songs, and so
just omnipresent. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
This guy had a definite leg up in that way. And but to the song itself, She's So High, that falsetto melody of that chorus, I mean, I think I was inclined to think that this style in this song was kind of lame, but then I secretly liked it. I think I liked this song, even though the style was very adult contemporary, and this was in my punkest of phases of my life. But yet I don't remember at any point not liking this song. I think even this was definitely, I don't know, at the time what I would have called a guilty pleasure, but now I would say like, oh, there's no such thing as guilty pleasure. I like everything.
Right.
It's fine.
Either you like it or you don't. Yeah.
But yeah, this song, it was kind of hard not to like that melody. It was just too crazy catchy.
Absolutely.
And according to, I never thought about this until I re-listened to the song after reading this, but according to an interview I saw with Tal Bachman, he said one of the biggest influences on the sound of the song was Sheryl Crow's If It Makes You Happy. And I kind of hear that.
I mean, it's the same chords. Is basically, I mean, I think primarily the chorus, you know, he said he was in a mall and he'd heard If It Makes You Happy. And he's like, oh, wow. And he had already written If You Sleep. So If You Sleep was the song that, okay, let's rewind just a little bit here. So back to the Randy Bachman thing, he didn't get a record deal based on his dad. A lot of people think that that's just kind of how it works when you've got a dad in the industry, and it couldn't be further from the truth. And so in his case, he went to every label in Canada and was rejected.
Really?
And the US. He just went all over the place with his demos and was rejected. And ultimately what happened was he did get his demo tapes submitted to someone in LA that fell in love with it. Sent it to EMI Publishing in New York. He ended up getting a publishing deal first. The publishing deal in turn got him the record deal, but She's So High wasn't even on there yet.
So I have a question about that, and I feel like you might be one of the best people to answer this because you've been in the music industry for so long. But literally this week I rewatched the Harry Nilsson documentary, Who is Harry Nilsson and Why is Everybody Talking About Him? And they mentioned that he also got signed as a publishing deal first. In that sense, I guess when you get signed to a publishing deal, if I'm understanding it correctly, the idea is we don't think that you'll be a musician, but we think that you write songs that bigger bands would be interested in purchasing, essentially, right? Is that like or am I completely off with that?
In Nilsson's case back in the day, yeah, that was the way it worked. But fast forward into modern times, no, it was just common that getting a publishing deal first, and it might be the case, but really they're thinking you're going to be going somewhere with these songs. So I think absolutely.
Because I could see it being either way with him. Like I could see them taking his songs and shopping it to another band and being like, hey, Dishwalla, this guy wrote this great song, She's So High. Are you interested in putting it on your next record type deal?
I tell you, 1999, we would have taken it, man. I mean, it was a little poppy for us, but in all honesty, we were kind of struggling. We were in between labels, and before we got picked up again by an independent label, I remember talking to our A&R person at Interscope, who had no point being, you know, it was Tom Brokaw's daughter, Andy Brokaw, that just like got a job because she liked records or something. And, you know, it's just like, at any rate, but you know, I was looking to get us hooked up with the writers for Smash Mouth with Greg Camp, you know, and stuff. You know, we were just, we were kind of having a rough time there, but yeah, Tal would have been perfect to do something like that, but no, he got a record deal. If You Sleep had already been written. That was really the song that got him the record deal. She's So High was written basically, I mean, it wasn't written as it, but it was released as a setup single. So it was just supposed to like get his name out there, get the word out a little bit. It was supposed to be a minor hit before we were really going to bring it on home with If You Sleep. The Dishwalla scenario happened with Counting Bukars. It was just like the song wouldn't go away
for months and months and months. The song wouldn't go away. They came out with If You Sleep. He made a video for it. Just super 90s. It just, it charted, you know. It did well, you know. It looks like it did better in some European countries and stuff, but it just didn't pan out.
But this song is still around. This is another one that you're still going to hear at the gas station, at the supermarket, wherever. This song has legs. It has staying power. You know, it's credit to being, it's an easy listen and it's catchy. And I got to talk about another from a songwriting part of this song is the Cleopatra, Joan of Arc, Aphrodite part that
you
I think
talk
just,
about that. Yeah,
it just sticks in your head. Like he shouts out these, you know, famous women from the ages. And I don't really, I mean, I guess he's saying that these women are so high above him, Cleopatra and Joan of Arc. And, you know, supposedly he wrote this song about a time in high school he tried to bribe a girl to date his stepbrother, which sounds kind of like a weird version of Can't Buy Me Love.
Uh-huh.
And he said that during the conversation, he began feeling uncomfortable, but also in awe of her. And then wrote this song about it at some point. Kind of a strange thing. But there's something about this song, and I don't know if I can put it in words. Maybe one of you guys can. But when Matt told me that Tal Bachman was Canadian, I was like, oh, yeah, of course he is. That totally makes sense.
Not only was he Canadian, his first tour was the most Canadian tour that may have ever happened, because he was the opening act for the Bare Naked Ladies and Bryan Adams, which is just like the trifecta of 90s Canadian musicians.
I think those are separate, but yeah.
As much as we talk about the chorus, this is another one of those songs where I think that the pre-chorus is just as earwormy, because that, you know, the how can a guy like me ever really offer, like that piece is just as catchy as the actual chorus building you into it.
I agree. Yeah,
absolutely.
That melody, that da 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 da. Yeah,
back to the Aphrodite thing. The only other time I can remember Joan of Arc being in a song was Big Mouth Strikes Again by the Smiths. But really, like, when do you ever hear, you know, this stuff? And I think that's why, and he made it work, you know. And I heard him say something that, you know, it was sort of a homage to these 60s artists. I can't remember if it's Cream, you know, something about Ulysses. And I mean, when I think about, like, whatever, even Zeppelin or Jethro Tull and some of these sort of proggy bands from the 70s that could pull off, you know, dramatic.
That's a perfect word for it too, man.
You don't get a lot of Greek and Roman mythology thrown into the middle of a song lyric. Like,
exactly. And that's just, I think that's totally coming from his classic roots and trying to weave that in some. And here we, you know, you find yourself in 1999 going, whoa, what the heck? You know, like, the first time hearing it, it sticks in your brain, but it sounds great. You know?
Calling it dramatic is perfect too, Scott, because there's something about it. And it's crazy because you brought up 1999. And yeah, of course, HBO, I got to watch it tonight, actually. HBO just released that Woodstock 99 documentary. So you think about this being the peak of Limp Bizkit and Break Stuff and whatever. And then you have this song where the guy's almost singing in a theatrical sort of like something you'd hear like Aphrodite, this like very over the top dramatic, so pop, so easy listening, so Gilmore Girls.
The other mind blow thing was like, she's so high. So the high word is the high note too. Uh-huh. It's like another thing that's like so like classic Broadway show tuney, you know, Lieber and Stoller. You know, American songbook kind of ism in there.
So on the nose for him to just go hi when he says hi. It's like, oh yeah, of course.
Exactly.
It's like what this song. Yeah, this song existed. It's one of those songs that just always existed. It's just Tal Bachman just channeled it because it just needed to happen.
But I think I don't think I fully understood how big of a hit this actually was until researching it, because the fact that in both Canada and the United States, it was a multi-format top 10 hit. So like it was a top 10 hit on three different charts simultaneously in Canada and three different charts in the States simultaneously. And then it went on to win the BMI Song of the Year and two Juno Awards.
back like, up, Matt. What three charts were these? I don't know what they are. I want to try to guess which three charts would this go on. Okay, so one of them has to be adult contemporary, right?
So actually, sorry, with this United States, it was four charts that it hit. Canada, it was
three. Okay, is one of them adult contemporary?
It says adult alternative. So we'll say that's about the
same. Okay, all right, AC, all right. Yeah. Adult alternative, as opposed to youth alternative. I don't know. Well, one top 40.
So mainstream, right? Top 40. Yep.
Okay. So is pop its own chart?
So this is where like the Billboard charts, especially in the 90s, were completely insane. And I feel like they had a lot of charts that are like one step aside from the other. It was the Hot 100, the adult alternative, the adult top 40, and then the mainstream top 40. So it was like number one on adult top 40, but number seven on mainstream top 40s. So the youth claims six higher spots than them, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay, I got you. And you know, I'm looking here too at what was going on. So this song, it says it only peaked at number 14. Now, that's the Hot 100.
That's on the Hot 100. It was
the
top
States?
20 on the Hot 100.
Okay. I don't mean to say only, but I thought maybe it
was the highest your
higher
song peaked at, Chris.
Hey, watch it. Scott had a way bigger. So one out of the three of this conversation could talk shit on number 14.
Yeah, but you know, also, you know, a lot of these charts, like the industry doesn't a lot of the time go off of the Billboard charts. It goes off of R&R, which is another competitor to Billboard, but it's a little bit more respected or something. It's the way that they culminate everything to get all the information together is a little bit more reliable. But yeah, multi-format hit.
Yeah, we're going off of Billboard. It was number 14 on August 28th, 1999. At the time, my fellow Pittsburgh native, who is also like a peer of mine, I think we're about the same age, Christina Aguilera, Genie in a Bottle, her first hit was number one at that time. Big congrats to her. I mean, she could sing her ass off. I think she deserved it. Also in the charts at that time, Enrique Iglesias, Balimos was number two. LFO, Summer Girls at number three. Horrendous song. I won't even hold back on that. That is a bad song. I'm sure Matt had the album and could tell you from front to back all about it. But that song really
I'm a big
sucked.
Fan of LFO and Rich Cronin, but yeah, continue.
Okay, Smash Mouth All Star. Okay, that I don't know what to think about that one. Pearl Jam, Last Kiss, Sugar Ray, Someday, and Red Hot Chili Peppers, Scar Tissue was on there at number 15 at the time. The best selling single of that entire year was Hit Me Baby One More Time for Britney Spears.
Gosh, such a weird time for pop rock. That's when you say these names. It's just like, oh yeah, this is when I can remember. You know, when I was telling you guys we got thrown onto Interscope. And Jimmy Iovine, who is like one of the most respected producers of all time, doing Tom Petty and Bruce Springsteen and stuff. But he was the president of Interscope Records at that time when they had Korn and Limp Bizkit and stuff. But he looked at basically he was in a marketing meeting with all these people. And he says, why are all these rock bands? Why are they all over 30 making music for 15-year-olds? And it was like right about that time where all of a sudden it like Eminem and Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera and LFO and the Macarena and, you know, all this stuff. Everything went like pop came back all of a sudden. So pop returned and alternative turned to new metal. And all of a sudden, Dishwalla and Tal Bachman and the Wallflowers. And we're just going, whoa, man, like, where do we go? We've got AAA and Hot AC now. Like, that's all we're left with. And these formats don't sell records. Alternative sells records and pop sells records. And so all of a sudden the what was the alternative rock, like, you know, a good, here's the thing. I mean, a lot of us bands like Verve Pipe, Dishwalla, Live, that were marketed alternative were really pop rock bands when you get down to it. I mean, there was an interview or I can remember at one point, you know, like a local paper were coming in, we're going to do a show. We pick up the local paper to see what the advertising looks like for our show or something. And they're like, this writer's like ripping us a new one, comparing us to Journey and stuff and Trickster. And it was just like trying to come up. But I thought about it. I was like, I guess it kind of is almost Journey for the 90s, you know? It's just like, this is, oh yeah, we are a pop rock band in this decade. And yeah, we're trying to write arena hits. And I guess that's what it is, you know? And
there's not, it's not a bad thing to try to write catchy, relatable music that you want to sing along to and that appeals to people. I think regardless of what genre you fall into, whether it's alternative or punk rock or whatever it happens to be, for the most part, unless you're Frank Zappa or something, you're trying to write music that people like and appeals to people and has a pop sensibility. So I mean, I wouldn't take the Journey thing as like,
I didn't either.
Guys,
and
you know, I think we're all trying to do that.
The Journey thing, I didn't at all.
My friend made a comment around this time that has always stuck with me, where he was talking about how he hated the terminology of alternative rock. And he's like, look, like when Nirvana came out, yes, it was an alternative to the rock music that was on, but he's like, but now we're just labeling any rock band as alternative rock. What are they the alternative of? They sound like all the same bands at this point.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, right. No, that's fair. Like at a certain point when all of the radio sounds the same, how is it alternative to anything at that point? It's just pop rock. Just call it what it is.
Right.
And own it.
Absolutely. It's because it came out of an era, you know, the decade before, you know, was really kind of like when I was coming up and I was into The Cure and Love and Rockets and Joy Division, New Order, and kind of like all these bands that were coming out of England that were really kind of creative and moving things along. There was only a couple what was alternative stations in the United States. You know, there was K-Rock in Los Angeles and you had HFS in Boston, and you know, there was another one up in New York, and Q101 Chicago, but there was just like, there wasn't really like, you, unless it was college radio, you couldn't know about these new bands that were happening. We didn't have a name for that music because it was no longer new wave, which was sort of like late 70s into the early 80s, and then punk didn't really fit a lot of, it didn't fit, I don't even think Nirvana or the Minutemen or like a lot of these sort of like harder bands at that point. Punk didn't really fit either. There wasn't really a name for it. And so the writers and radio and the industry needs to put names on things. And that's how grunge wasn't something invented by people in Seattle. I'm sorry. You know, nobody called themselves a grunge band. That would just be the stupidest thing.
No, I don't think so.
We're Alice in Chains and we are a grunge band. You know, it's just like.
Nobody ever likes those blanket generalization terms that they're like, no emo band liked being called an emo band. No pop punk band liked being called a pop punk band. You said something, Scott, you touched on something that is very much why I don't like that term. You said something that Jimmy Iovine said, like, why are 30-year-olds writing songs for 15-year-olds? Is you saw so much of that. It's like, you guys are full-grown adults and you're acting like you're freshmen in high school and writing songs about that. It wasn't necessarily the style. Like, you know, I love Where It Came From. I grew up on punk rock and I like melody and all that, but it was just like the subject matter and the style got so, like, some of my least favorite stuff, even though my band is in that world. I'm like, when people say that word, it like, ugh, you know, it would kind of like, along what you're saying, do you think that like, the grunge bands liked being called grunge?
They didn't. You know, I can remember seeing an MTV interview with Kurt Cobain back in the day, and like they're sitting by a river or something like that, and he's Kurt smoking a cigarette. You know, he's just, and the interviewer says like, "How does it feel to be a grunge band?" or something like that, and he's just like, "I thought it was a new waver," and I was just like, "Oh my gosh!" Like I'm with you. I'm like a new waver, and we're just kind of stuck in this weird world where your corporate is putting names on things. And, you know, we're really more influenced by the 80s, not so much like what's going on right now. You know,
did Dishwalla ever get hit with one of my favorite kind of nonsense genre terms of, were you considered a post grunge band at any point during your run? I remember that was a big, like, felt like any band on alternative radio from like 96 to 98, they're like Silverchair, Bush, they're post-grunge.
I think we dodged that a little bit just because we weren't the Nixons and Seven Mary Three and all these bands that had an Eddie Vedder sounding vocalist, you know, you know, kind of sounding singer to it.
Marble
you
know, Mouth.
So, I mean, JR did throw a little bit of that in there, you know, but for the most part, we kind of dodged it. And Kenny McCars is such a weird sounding song, like where it was coming from, like, you know, it was almost a bit more 80s than it was 90s, but it worked. And I can remember the day that, you know, the guitar player and I were kind of working out the chords to this song, and we're in our rehearsal studio, and we were actually trying to play a song by a band called Catherine Wheel. And that had a record called Chrome.
Oh, I remember that band.
So we were trying to play this tune by Catherine Wheel. We were trying to figure out the chords, and it essentially turned into another song. And there was a lot of bands that were kind of chasing that Catherine Wheel sound, Failure being another one, and where it was sort of a dissonant kind of sound where the bass is going against the chords that I'm not playing the roots of the chord. Necessarily. Exactly. It sounded different, you know, and so I think we dodged a bit of this grunge type of thing as a result. I'm not sure.
Right.
Plus, we were just poppier.
Yeah. I wouldn't have put you in that realm either. Hey, I heard the first time, hey, Scott, in 2019, before the pandemic hit, one of the last tours that my band did is we did the Jim Blossoms tour, the New Miserable Experience tour. We were like the opening band on that tour, which was amazing. I love that band. Freaking love that band. And I had never heard before that tour the term jangle pop. I didn't know jangle pop was a genre. Yeah.
It's not really a genre, but like when you don't know how to like address that sound, I think power pop is maybe a more applicable term to a lot of these, what we called pop punk, really, you know, is fast.
I like that.
I love power pop as a genre name.
Yeah, I like that too. I've used that to like, if I'm trying to give someone a broad generalization of what my band sounds like, power pop, that doesn't sound as bad. You know, I don't know, something about pop punk or calling it, I'd kind of sometimes feel bad calling ourselves punk, even though we're influenced by the sonic stylings of punk. It's not like we're railing against the government. I do that on my own time. I do that on my own time, not too much in our music.
But I think that's the thing, you know, the original crew of, you know, the Sex Pistols or not so much the Ramones, but, you know, there was a lot of railing against the government, especially in like, you know, the way the times were on the West Coast. You know, I'm from Santa Barbara, and we had, you know, first there was this band called RKL. And RKL kind of
rich kids on LSD.
You know, RKL influenced Lagwagon, and we got, you know, all these bands, you know, Sugar Cult later on, and No Use for a Name. We got Chris Shiflett, and then we got Scott Shiflett and Face to Face, and all these people kind of grew out of going to see RKL play when they were kids, you know, and they all sort of grew up together. Right. And it was just sort of a scene, but it was pretty angry, you know, it was pretty gnarly. And so it wasn't more like, I'd say, the Buzzcocks, which I would say is a pop punk band, but just in the late 70s, you know, and the Green Day that came later, and then Blink 182 and all the bands that sounded like that were kind of more disciples of the Buzzcocks, I think.
Descendants are the band that I think of when it comes to like what power pop is, as far as like how I interpret it, is like, yeah, it was melodic, interesting musically, and relatable, you know, had the love songs, had that sort of things, and it wasn't necessarily all about you know, the government and stuff where punk originated.
I think any title of a genre where it sort of like discredits like the content and how good these artists actually were, whether it's grunge or pop punk or whatever it is, I think that's what pisses artists off. It's like, you know what, there's some legit talent and, you know, incredible songs in there, and we're just sort of like discrediting it and lumping it all together.
Right. Lumping it all together is the best way to put it too, because it's like basically most bands who are frustrated by being pigeonholed or whatever, generalized, it's basically they just want to be like, yeah, we're a band. Yeah. We're a music band. We make music.
Right.
Bands and vans. That is a very good. Yeah, we're a band in a van. Like we write songs from the heart. We go out and play them. You know, Dishwalla would fit in there. I don't know if you guys were in a van or a bus at that. I'm sure by the time Counting Blue Cars came out,
we were still in the darn van, and they made us stay in the van for way too long, and it was a drag because we were label mates with Tonic. And Tonic was like, van, like, screw that. They got a van. They toured it for like a month, you know, and then they're like, give us the bus. We don't care. Well, because like, I remember Emerson saying to me, he's just like, either this thing flies and it's got legs and we financially do okay, or it doesn't and we go home. And we're just going to give us the bus.
It could have been way worse. Right. Knowing the 90s and how marketing was, they could have made you just go on tour in multiple blue cars.
Yeah.
Hey, bringing it back around to Tal Bachman and what he's been up to since his hit.
Yeah.
So apparently in 2004, he decided to take a 15-year break from music.
Is that right? So Aeroplane,
yeah,
and the track that's on American Pie, that's around 04?
Yeah. So here's the thing that's really weird about this. That's his second album, which already came out 5 years after the first album, which I feel like is sometimes a huge death sentence to a musician with that long of a break. But it came out in Canada in 2004, and then it didn't come out in the United States until 2 years after, in 2006.
I wish I would have asked him what the story was there. You know, I really wish I had talked to him a little bit about, like, I've never really seen or heard him talk much about what went wrong. Why didn't the record label just go boom and do another record right after, and why that lag was there.
Well, it seems like he was very busy creating children. He had eight yeah, kids from the time he was in his early 20s. So that may have distracted him a little bit from the music. He then became a rugby player and a political commentator. And
well, he grew up playing rugby, I know. And, you know, yeah, he did continue to play through all that, stay in shape. I think it was more of a club team kind of thing. Gotcha. But yeah, I mean, he's freaking gnarly.
Yeah, I saw at one point, hey, talk about still being relevant to young people in recent years, you know. Aside from the fact that the song has stuck around. Now, this was in Canada. I think it was Vancouver where this video is from. But mm-hmm. I saw a video of Taylor Swift playing in Vancouver, bringing him out to play She's So High together, and the whole arena, or whatever it was, stadium, singing along to it. So obviously that song has still makes an impact among young people in recent years. You know, it didn't just go away and be listened to by 50-year-old moms or something. It stuck around, you know, so that's to its credit, you know, and to his credit.
Absolutely. And I think Taylor wouldn't have made that whole thing happen if she didn't love the song.
Yeah.
You know, and felt comfortable bringing him onto her stage. I mean, I thought that spoke volumes.
Right.
But to see him up there and that crowd going crazy like that was just like, oh yeah, I mean, this is still like touches something in people, you know. It's really cool.
Undeniable.
So here's my favorite though of all the stuff that I found on his wiki page, and I wish that I had done a deeper dive to research more about this, but in 2012 he found out that the Cactus Club Cafe was no longer serving key lime pie and spearheaded a campaign to get it added back to the menu. And now I'm sitting here and I'm like, did he Weird Al She's So High to be key lime pie? Because if not, he missed a great opportunity right there.
Where's the Cactus Club Cafe? I don't even know where that is. Is that
It's in Vancouver. It was a Vancouver location.
Sometimes people go into wiki pages, obviously, and write extremely weird stuff. That could have been written by a waitress or something that he freaked out on, or who knows, you know. But there's some weird crap on our wiki pages that is just like flat out just not true, you know.
So, yeah, his wiki page is pretty sparse, and I think that that's why I like it so much, is that there's not a lot of information on it.
It's a big
but the
gap.
Key lime pie incident is definitely on there.
Before we make our verdict on if this is thunder or a blunder, there's a couple more little weird facts about this. 4 years after the song came out, a Norwegian artist named Kurt Nielsen, not familiar with him. I'm not. I don't know if you guys are big Kurt Nielsen fans, but he covered this song, covered She's So High, and it became Norway's best-selling single ever. Ever.
It's as
this Kurt Nielsen cover.
So that thing, that's as a result of American Idol. He not only won American Idol in Norway, but he won American Idol, or sorry, not American Idol. I guess it's like Norwegian Idol or whatever it is, but he won Idol worldwide. And that song was performed, I guess, like several times over the course of like how many shows there was and stuff. So anyway, that was a huge boon for Tal's ASCAP checks, or excuse me, BMI checks, you know, the royalties that he was able to get from that must have been.
It's got to be. How much does it probably suck to have the best selling single in your country's history and you didn't write the song, so you're probably not getting nearly as much of a cut of having the biggest song.
About that on his end. Like, this kid's got the biggest selling single of all time, and Tal's getting all the royalties.
So the only other thing that I wanted to give a weird shout out to is his return to music in 2019, and I love this. He came out under the stage name Ian Starglow, and his debut album under that name is called Ian Starglow's Greatest Hits Volume 1. That's some serious Garth Brooks, Chris Gaines power right there, and I kind of love it.
I didn't know about that fact. That's, yeah.
Yeah, so...
yeah, that's cool.
Tal was telling me a little bit about that, and what that was he'd written a screenplay, I guess, and... basically, he had written a pilot, and I think maybe they shot the pilot, but he's basically created a character, this character, Ian Starglow, that's this sort of like British rock star from the 70s, and they built this show around him, and he was trying to sell
it. That is exactly the Chris Gaines situation. That's hysterical to me.
Yeah.
Because I'm pretty sure that's the Chris Gaines thing. It was like Garth Brooks was going to make a movie about a rock musician named Chris Gaines.
I don't think he's given up on it. I think he's just, you know, still probably trying to, you know, find someone that's interested in doing that. But, you know,
I would watch either one of those. I think that's awesome to like create a fictional character, make a greatest hits album for this fictional character, and then do like a movie or documentary about like a 20-year span in this character's career. That's so fun and smart. I love it.
Yeah. He's a brilliant guy. I mean, he's just like, I don't know what the dude's IQ is, but Tal is just sort of like, I just think about the life that this guy has lived. You know, it's just, it kind of blows me away that he's the son of this massive Canadian rock star that is living in like a Volkswagen bus with his brothers and sisters, just dirt poor. And then all of a sudden they're living in this mansion outside of Seattle that he grew up in, and that house just recently sold. Like, you can Google it, the Randy Bachman estate. It's like 30 acres. I mean, it's like, and you imagine little Tal riding big wheels and around. It looks like freaking Graceland. It's just crazy. It's got a recording studio in the house. It's massive, and it's where BTO did a lot of recording and stuff in that house. The complications of, you know, probably having his dad gone, you know, a good portion of him growing up, you know, being active in a lot of different things. He majored in political science and stuff, so he's super sharp. And, you know, he's a concern. I know you guys are more on the liberal side of things, but, you know, he's a political analyst that, you know, years ago he was on TV a lot more in Canada, but he does these Stein Online pieces for Mark Stein, and he's super... his Twitter and his Facebook is way more political. He rarely talks about music unless it pertains to like a show he's got coming up with his dad or something.
Are you saying that he's conservative? Are you saying he's a conservative? Because I looked into it, and I feel like Canadian conservative is a little bit different than like
it is.
What it means
you.
In America. Yeah. it's a little less harsh.
I think so too.
Also, hey, Scott, I got to challenge something you said a little bit earlier. Though.
Yeah.
You said earlier that, you know, Tal's success had nothing to do with the fact that his dad was from the Guess Who and his uncle was from BTO. I would kind of challenge that and say you have a little bit of a foot in the door.
I think you're right. In the U.S., he had a foot in the door, and that got him listened to. But in Canada, it worked against him, and it was fun for A&R guys to say, right, Randy Bachman's kid's a singer. I just threw it right in the trash. You know, it's just like, he just automatically, by maybe not even really giving it a legitimate listen, just said no.
I even think a foot in the door doesn't even necessarily have to mean, hey, this person got signed specifically because of blank, blank, and blank. But like, obviously, and this is coming from the least musical of the three of us on this call, but like, if I had a demo, I wouldn't even know thing one about who to send it to get it moving somewhere. So there has to at least be the slight advantage of being like, hey, Dad, who should I send this demo to?
Well, you know, he got some direction. Absolutely. I mean, yeah. You know, he got some good help. But, you know, Dad couldn't pull it together for him. And Canada, he's basically like, screw you, Canada. I'm going to the United States to figure this out. And the U.S. didn't have all the stigma attached to his dad like it did up there. And you got to remember also, like, Jacob Dylan, you know, the Wallflowers did have a failed record before they had a record that and they got dropped, you know. And so maybe it got his foot in the door to get a record deal, but they made a record that went nowhere, essentially, and built a new band, and then essentially signed a new deal, and they had success. But and then another one I can remember, this kid, Colby Calais, her dad produced like all of Fleetwood Mac's records. Ken Calais, he's like a bro of mine. Same thing with her. Like, Ken couldn't really just walk her into Warner Brothers and get her a deal on Fleetwood Mac's label or something like that. She was singing in coffee houses, and you know, she was just a MySpace success. It was really what happened. Right. So it's not a guaranteed thing if you've got a parent in the industry. In fact, it could work against you. I feel that Jacob Dylan's music doesn't have a whole lot to do with his dad's acoustic songwriting of the early 60s. No. I mean, it really doesn't. And he made a point that even visually and the aesthetic of the Wallflowers is not going to be a hippy dippy kind of 60s-ish vibe. We're dressing in black. We're going another direction. And Tal, same thing. Like, when I think of Randy Bachman, I think of like pentatonic blues, like American Woman rock, like, you know, ain't seen nothing yet. Like, I think straight ahead, like, power chords. Like, Tal's record is pretty, I don't want to say complicated, but you know, there's a lot of Beach Boys, there's a lot of 70s singer songwriters. It's musically a lot more dense and chordally. There's a lot more color going on than his dad's music. It doesn't really have a whole lot to do with his dad's approach to things. It's very different, in my opinion.
And I think, again, with the 20-year separation there with both Jake Dylan and Tal, like, when I was a kid in middle school and those albums are dropping, I don't really know or care who Bob Dylan or the Guess Who is at that time. I just know that I really like this song. So, like, the fact that they're the kid of this, like, god of music means nothing to the middle schooler or the high schooler that's buying it.
They're trying to appeal to buy that record. Exactly.
Right.
Yep.
So, all right. Meant nothing. So, we'll go. We got to go around. Scott, I'm assuming you're giving Tal a thunder pass. Am I correct?
Big time thunder pass. And not only for She's So High, but the whole entire record. Like, I would just encourage people to go back, get on Spotify, and review this whole thing, because it's freaking genius. The whole record, all the way through, is just absolutely beautiful. And putting it into today's landscape, it's just like such a breath of fresh air because of the way that, I don't know, there's probably good rock music out there somewhere, but I'm kind of lost in it the last several years. So I don't know. Gotcha. Big time thunder for me.
Gotcha. Matt?
I mean, I listened to this song a lot as a kid. It's constantly popping up in the type of like 90s teen flicks that I revisit time and time again. So this is like a warm blanket song for me in general. So I'm going with thunder as well. So, Chris, are you going to make it a three-way thunder? Are you going to...
based on the fact that, even at the time when I may have thought I was too cool for something like this that was on the radio and so over-the-top pop music that I liked it then, that's where I would lean. But the fact that then he took a 15-year break from music and became a conservative political commentator in Canada, I don't think that's so cool. I don't think that's very thunder of him, but the song is strong. I dug into his catalog a little bit more. I listened to Aeroplane. I listened to a few other songs. I think this was like far and away the best song that I heard, but the other stuff was passable, and I think that I can also give this. I think I can make it a passable. I think I can make it a three-way thunder here. I think Tal did all right for himself, and especially considering this is the time he's releasing this song. This is a good point that, you know, Scott touched on earlier. This is at like the height of like Limp Bizkit and stuff. So if you can rise above the noise out there with a song like this, I got to give him props for that. So I'll give it a thunder.
Well, Scott, thank you so much for joining us. Do you have anything worth promoting? The world's starting to open up again. Does Dishwalla have anything on the horizon?
Yeah, Dishwalla is really kind of become the masters of just doing one-offs. We fly out, we get together a few times a year and do some shows now. Previous years, we'd been touring a bit more, but you know, like last year? No, the year before, I think we came out and we played out by you guys, and we did this out by Bethlehem Steel. which is like
that's Matt's neck of the woods.
It's outside. Yeah. It's out by Penn. Exactly. There's a park. It's incredible. This old steel mill, and they lit it up with lights and stuff, and it's this massive structure, and they made the steel for the Empire State Building and the Golden Gate Bridge there, and now it's just a concert venue, and so we played there.
Oh, that's awesome.
A couple years ago, but
find a show there and go to it.
Cracker had played the week before us, but yeah, they're having really good shows out there. But yeah, we love Pennsylvania. We recorded Pet Your Friends in Conshohocken, which is outside Philadelphia.
Yeah, that's like 10 minutes from me. That's where most of my family lives.
Oh, right on. So we'd go to dinner in Manayunk, and we had a condo in King of Prussia.
Nice.
Go to the mall and stuff on days off. But that's where we tracked our first record, because the Phil Niccolo, the Butcher Brothers, were there with Studio 4. And they had done Urge Overkill and Cypress Hill and a bunch of stuff out there that we liked. So
That's awesome. I had no clue about that.
Yeah, I'd never been anywhere. You know, I grew up sort of poor in Santa Barbara, California. I'd never been anywhere. I'd never seen fall before coming to Pennsylvania. And so, when we came out to make
You get all the seasons for better or for worse out here.
It was so cool. I mean,
our winters and summers suck, but like the month and a half that it's either fall or spring, it's great.
Incredible. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. Right on, you guys.
Cool. Hey, thanks for coming on, Scott. This was pretty exciting. And thanks for, not being mad at me. I don't think I said anything bad
even if you did, you know, you got to know too, like, you know, we're one of those bands that even our best bros, you know, are just like, dude, sick of that song. And, you know, like, we're not fans of, you know, not really fans of our band, you know, and it's funny how things work out. You know, I was in another band that I thought was going to get a record deal and was going that direction. And the drummer for Dishwalla was also in that band, and he kind of yanked me and pulled me into this other thing that it wasn't called Dishwalla yet, but you know, yanked me into this other situation, and it just started doing well really rapidly. You know, it was coming out of the 80s. It was called Life Talking, and those dudes just, the material was just not going to work in a post Nirvana world. Mm-hmm. You know, and right. We rewrote the material, and the band was called Dish. This is like before the internet, so we couldn't just Google to see if that name already existed for a band. Got a cease and desist letter from a band called Dish. Had to change the name, you know. And we threw that Walla on there from a Wired magazine article. We saw these people pirating satellite television, and it was just supposed to be for like a couple gigs, and we were going to change the name. And you know, it just stuck, and the band took off pretty quick. But you know, it's just funny how things work out. You know.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Hell yeah, man. Well, thanks again, man.
Yeah.
This has been One Hit Thunder. One Hit Thunder is hosted by Chris Mathalios of the bands Punchline, Pack, and Another Cheetah, and produced by Matt Kelly of Geekscape.net. Underneath me, you're hearing Heart of Gold off the Punchline B-Sides album, Night Lights. Visit punchline.com for merch, new music, and upcoming shows. If you have any interest in podcasting, visit weknowpodcasting.com for how Chris and I can make your show sound as professional as possible. Let us know your thoughts on the show by emailing us at onehitthunderpodcast@gmail.com. Make sure to rate, review, and subscribe to us on your favorite podcasting app. And tune in next week for another episode of One Hit Thunder.
I don't know. Everyone has a podcast now.
Well, not really. What is true is that, according to Nielsen statistics, 55% of the U.S. population, that's over 155 million people, have listened to a podcast, and 24% of the population, that's 68 million people, listen to podcasts weekly. And these numbers continue to trend upward.
What's also true is that over 75% of all podcasts fade away after the first few episodes. It could be for a variety of reasons: lack of strong concept, poor production value, people not realizing how much time needs to be dedicated to it, or simply just not knowing how to get the word out about podcasts. That's where WeKnowPodcasting.com comes in.
At WeKnowPodcasting.com, we have a combined 25 years of podcast experience, and we can help you achieve your podcasting goals. Whether you need help starting a new podcast or want to take your currently active podcast to the next level, we got you. From consultations to concept development, from theme music to editing, promotion, animation, graphics, you name it, and we're here to help.
Don't become another failed podcast statistic. Let us guide you and help your show become a success. Check out the website at WeKnowPodcasting.com, and even if you're on the fence, don't hesitate to reach out. We're friendly guys, we're passionate about pods, and we're here to help.
You're listening to the Geekscape Network.